Today on The Whistleblowers, the neocons, America's favorite warmongers. We in the alternative media love to hate them. Carnage and destruction abroad, poverty and suicide for veterans back home. The successful operation to kidnap Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro is just the latest jewel in their crown. You have to hand it to them, frankly. The neoconservatives have dominated American foreign policy for at least the past quarter century. Today we ask, will the neocons continue to dominate, or is their star finally fading? I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Whistleblowers. In 2001, General Wesley Clark listed seven total countries that the Bush administration wanted to take out, starting back in the early 2000s.
Stairs, meeting the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran. I said, is it classified? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me.
That work is still in progress today. By my reckoning, the neocons have gone almost 7 for 7. The Bush administration ripped through Saddam Hussein's military in a matter of weeks in early 2003. The war and the years-long insurgency battles killed more than a million Iraqis, many of them children, even babies who suffered from starvation or malnutrition. Iraq is still a sectarian mess, and its future is bleak. Muammar Gaddafi's Libya fell in 2011. Libya was once a beacon of hope for Africa. Colonel Gaddafi used the nation's oil wealth to improve social services, crush poverty, and massively improve life expectancy and literacy. He hardly deserved to be sodomized with a bayonet. And Libya hardly deserves to be one of the most dysfunctional societies on earth, serving as a transit point for migrants into Europe and a place with well-known and well-documented open-air slave markets. Somalia and Sudan stood little chance where Libya and Iraq failed. Sudan is now split into two countries and effectively out of the picture. Somalia is perhaps the only country that beats Libya in its dysfunction. Israel's recent recognition of Somaliland also splits that country into two parts. Lebanon still has a barely functioning government, but Israel regularly makes it the target of airstrikes and terror attacks, like the now infamous 2024 pager detonations. Without support from Iran and with its former neighbor Syria now in shambles, Lebanon's future is bleak at best. Syria is the most recent example of a neocon success story. For years, the United States, Turkey, and their proxies tried to break Bashar al-Assad's Syrian government until Russian involvement in 2015 turned the tables and stabilized the region. It looked like the neocons had finally chewed off more than they could handle. Then, in a matter of just 2 weeks, al-Qaeda, with the support of the United States and Turkey, toppled the government and forced Assad to flee Damascus. Ahmed al-Sharaa, the former al-Qaeda member known as al-Jolani, is now in charge of that country, and horrifying videos have emerged of Christians literally being crucified by Islamic militants. Meanwhile, Jolani chums it up at the United Nations with Western leaders as if there are no problems. And then there's Iran, the golden jewel in the neocon crown of devastation and ruined nation-states. Iran still maintains its sovereignty and is a powerful regional force in Central Asia and the Middle East. But pressure is mounting, and the U.S. has shown that it can bomb Iran with impunity, as it did during Operation Midnight Hammer. If Iran falls, and the future is far from clear, the neocons will have remade an entire region in their image within just a quarter of a century. But could the failure to smash Russia on the anvil of Ukraine prove a turning point for the planned neocon dominance? And will Venezuela hold out against mounting pressure from the Trump administration despite the abduction of President Nicolas Maduro? For this, we turn to our guest, Dr. Glenn Deason. Dr. Deason is a political scientist, author, and podcast host, and he's also a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway. Dr. Deason, welcome to the show. We're glad to have you.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Let me start with this. Do you see it this way? Have the neocons essentially had their way in American foreign policy in the past 25 years? In a sort of a morbid sense, do they deserve more respect than we in the dissident alternative media give them?
Well, it's hard to say if they... I think they have a lot of the wind out of their sails, but that could possibly make them more dangerous. Mm. That is, you know, when he says threats, you look at both capabilities and intentions, but we also see that capabilities tend to influence intentions. So, for example, when the Cold War came to an end and the U.S. was the sole superpower in the world, this is when you saw people like Wolfowitz coming forth and making the argument that now we have a window of opportunity to essentially clean up the Middle East. Let's get rid of Iraq. Let's get rid of a lot of our traditional opponents. They don't have a great power to support them. And this was also the argument of the American scholar Stephen Walt, that the greatest challenge for the U.S. From the 90s and onwards was, without any balancer, who would constrain the U.S.? Because states don't tend to constrain themselves. So it would go in all directions. So suddenly these ideas that militarism should be the main solution to all foreign policy issues, it suddenly got a lot of traction. Now, the reason why I'm feared that they can become more dangerous is, in the past, it looked as if over the past 30 years, they wanted to take advantage of this hegemonic position to remake the world in its own image through military force. But now, as we see that the unipolar order is over, there seems to be dreams of restoring the hegemon, but then you need to crush and defeat Iran. You need to defeat Russia. You need to defeat China. And suddenly you're looking at something very different than these small and medium-sized wars.
Professor, I spent 15 years at the CIA and then another 2 years at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And it was clear to anyone with a functioning brain that this neoconservative policy to just go around the world and topple governments that you don't like, regardless for the blowback and hatred that it creates for the United States, just was not a viable long-term policy. How has it survived this long, and where did it originate in the first place?
Oh, now his name, I lost his name, but there was... In 1990, there was an American scholar who wrote The Unipolar Moment. And the argument was that the world is simply unipolar. This is how the world is at the moment. In the future, it might be multipolar. But until then, we should act as a sole superpower. Now, the premise of that assumption would be that once new centers of power emerged, it would be acceptable for the U.S. and its allies to transition into a multipolar system. I think the flaw here is that we had now 30 years, an entire political class has been grown up under this ideology that the hegemony is the only source for peace. That is the only way we can avoid rivalry between great powers is if the U.S. is all dominant, and the only way liberal democracy and human rights can thrive is under the U.S. hegemon. So I think this is one has to appreciate the political forces which really came to play into the 1990s. That is, on one hand, you had these neocons who would aspire for perpetual hegemony, but then they kind of merged a bit with the, we'll call them bleeding hearts, the people who wanted more democracy promotion, defense of human rights, because they recognized that liberal democratic values was tied into the dominance of an entity of power. So I think this unholy alliance, it still continues today. And I think it was obvious for many that it would end. And indeed, many of the criticism to the unipolar moment in the 1990s was twofold. One, the U.S. would eventually exhaust itself in material, in blood, economy, but also its own reputation. And also, if it pushes out in every direction, it's going to be counterbalanced. So you're going to have large growing powers around the world, such as BRICS. That is, what does the Brazilian, Russian, Indians, Chinese, and South Africans have in common now with Iran and others as well? Well, they want to balance the hegemon. Mm-hmm. None of them want to live under the dominance of a world police. So this is what you see. So I think it was always doomed to be temporary. And the more the U.S. now tries to prolong it, the more it convinces the rest of the world that, no, this is it. We can't continue to live under this declining system.
I want to thank our director, who tells me that it was Charles Krauthammer, Dr. Charles Krauthammer.
Yeah.
Yes. Who,
sorry.
Who
been a first, long day.
No, that's okay. I want to ask you also about Lebanon. There's nothing good coming out of Lebanon. How do you see that country's future? It's the only regional ally to Iran. They don't share a land border, not even close. And Iran has been all but isolated. Where does that leave the Lebanese?
Well, in a very weakened position. Mm-hmm. And I think, it's kind of obvious that the Israelis are also looking to pick them off, because mm-hmm. once they were able to knock out Syria, that is remove Assad and have Jolani in their place, it makes it makes Lebanon much, much weaker. And in the introduction, you mentioned some of the attacks they've done, such as the pagers. And I just think, the effort is to disconnect them from the Iranians. And while Syria used to be the bridge between them, now you see possibly using the new Syrian government under Jolani,
right,
to actually go after Lebanon, while the Israelis are doing the same from the south. So I don't see a great future for Lebanon. I think there will be a lot of pressure on the Lebanese government to begin to try to disarm Hezbollah, but then you have them fighting each other instead. So no, I don't see any great future there at all.
I have to ask you also about Syria and what appeared to be just a sudden collapse of the Syrian government. I was one of many people who said that the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know, and whether you like Bashar al-Assad's politics or not, he was the only thing standing between the minority communities, the Christian communities, the Druze, the Jews, and complete annihilation. And then his government collapsed in a matter of just a couple of weeks. How did that happen?
Well, it's a great question. You probably know more than me on this, but my impression was that there were both the military and economic system there in Syria had been exhausted, and many could be bought off as well. And again, it did take me by surprise how quickly this was done as well. So I think the poor conditions and the ability to buy off was a key reason. But I'd just like to add he did stand behind he represented order as opposed to the chaos mm-hmm. you see now. And often when they were selling the war in Syria, it was always the same idea, that is, either you support Assad and all the crimes he has committed, otherwise you will back us in trying to remove him by force. We do the same in Iran now, by the way. Either you have to pretend as if there's no external involvement, that the objective of the Western countries is not to destroy destroy the country, or you are an apologist for the regime. Then this is usually how political propaganda works. You set up this simplistic binary option. It goes all the way back to the Yugoslav war. Either you support us bombing Yugoslavia illegally, or you take the side of Milosevic or Anne Applebaum. Either you support us bombing Iraq, or you hate freedom. I mean, this is how they always play it. But the reality is that Assad was protecting a lot of the minorities, and now that he's gone, you see them being slaughtered. And when they were being slaughtered, the EU had to comment on it. They actually blamed the people being slaughtered. The Druze mm-hmm. and all, they said, well, the Alawites, they are Assadists provoking the government. And this was the response. So providing cover for the ISIS government they helped install.
If there is a conflict in Iran, do you see Russia and China getting involved in any way, even if it's diplomatically? And to what degree do you think either the Russians or the Chinese might come to Iran's aid?
Well, I think to some extent they already are, because they are helping to rebuild Iran's capabilities. So I think this is I don't think they would want to get into a shooting war with the United States, but I think they would do everything they could to prop up everything from offering the intelligence, anything they have of surveillance, the living weapon systems, so however they can help, because this is not just another regime change. This is a key component of the southern parts of the Eurasian continent. Keep in mind that a key strategic objective that unifies both the Russians and the Chinese is this Greater Eurasian Partnership, is what the Russians call it, which is to connect all these major powers on the Eurasian continent closer with each other. So China, India, Russia, Iran, and connect it with new technological partnerships, more integrating their industrial bases physically with new transportation corridors by land and sea, developing their common banks, mm-hmm. payment systems, use of local currencies. In this whole system, Iran is a very important component. If you only look at the physical connectivity, they connect with the Chinese infrastructure projects. They're also part of this international north-south transportation corridor between Russia, Iran, and India. So it's a key piece in that puzzle. So if, they stand a lot to lose if it would be possible to knock out Iran and have a regime change and install some puppet regime, which would be then hostile perhaps to right. Russia and China. So I think they would go to a large extent to make sure that this does not happen.
Dr. Glenn Deason, stay right there. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to speak with Dr. Deason about more related to the future of the neoconservatives. Stay tuned. This is The Whistleblowers. Welcome back. Today we're discussing the neoconservatives and their path of destruction with our guest, Dr. Glenn Deason. Dr. Deason is a political scientist, he's an author, and he's a successful podcast host. He's also a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway. Welcome back.
Thanks again.
We have seen what we've been calling here neocon dominance. Does the future, in your view, look the same for the neocons? Will they continue to hold sway over American foreign policy? And the reason I ask is because this MAGA movement, this Make America Great Again movement that Donald Trump has adhered to, was supposed to be a no-war movement. And now in the second term, we're seeing lots of war. What do you think?
No, I think, on some level, Trump was always a bit ambiguous because he knew that people were upset about the failings, which were these forever wars. They just kept on going. They drained the U.S. of resources, and they didn't lead to any successes. So I think that he went with this America first, and then it was a wide net. It caught a lot of people in. But once you have to translate this into actual actions and policies, you have to be a bit more specific, because for some, America first meant no more wars. Let's try to save the republic by scaling back the empire. For others, it meant, well, we just have to unleash more fierce military force on the world to get what we want. We shouldn't be constraining ourselves with international law and all this, fear of world war, all of this other consideration, such as what Pig Hegseth mm-hmm. appears to think, that international law is some woke conspiracy. But no, I agree. I think Trump, he hasn't been the man of peace, which he sold himself as during the campaign. He has continued the war on Russia, and the U.S. is very much front and center still in this. He criticized Biden for attacking Yemen. He does exactly the same. He backs the slaughter in Gaza. He attacks the nuclear facilities in Iran, which is in itself quite absurd and crazy. He attacks Venezuela without a plan of how this will actually play out. Kidnaps his president. He threatens Mexico. He threatens Cuba, Nicaragua, Colombia. He's going to take Greenland from Denmark. Of course, the Chinese economy has to be crippled as well. So you see, behind all of this is an aspiration to restore global primacy. But if you want global primacy, then you need a very powerful military. And this is the whole neocon ticket. That is, we need to be the dominant military and solve problems with military means. Well, Trump now says, well, we really need to increase our military budget by 50%. So going from $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion. This is not the Trump from the campaign. This is neocon Trump. And
Back in November, the Trump administration published a new strategy document. These things come out every several years. This document seemed to signal a shift toward a more America First strategy, but then while still giving nods to U.S. involvement around the globe against places like Iran or China, and again in the Western Hemisphere, do you see anything in this national security strategy document that indicates any major shift away from a neoconservative policy?
No, I think it does recognize the multipolar realities. I mean, multipolarity is not a policy. It's a reality that is the distribution of power. And it creates some problems for the United States. That is, unlike in the hegemonic order, it can't be everywhere at the same time. It has to start making priorities. And it appears from this national security strategy, the priority means we have to dominate the Western Hemisphere, so make sure that other centers of power like China doesn't have too heavy of a footprint, but also Russia. And we also have to be in Asia so we can contain the Chinese. But if you pivot to somewhere, then you have to pivot away from another place, and that will be Europe. So it recognizes that Europe is, it's weakening itself. Its economy is declining, the ability to reproduce culture. Indeed, civilization itself is threatened. The leadership becomes more authoritarian. So, a pretty pessimistic view. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with most of it. I think it's a lot of this is correct. But but there's a wider idea, which is in the hegemonic era when the U.S. was more confident, it could finance or support frontline states. But in the multipolar world, it's a necessity to pull back a bit and get some more U.S. control. So you see this with the Taiwanese. We want the semiconductor industries to be moved over to the U.S.
Yes.
Same with Japan. You should produce more in the U.S., same as the South Koreans. Essentially, countries should also pay for the privilege of being protected by the United States. Greenland, we need this for our defenses. Yes, we are allies in NATO, but that might not be enough. So, you have to transfer that as well. And so you see more extractive relationship with allies. And this is very difficult for the allies because the U.S. was extremely generous after World War II in terms of trade agreements, security arrangements. But now the U.S. was then in a powerful position. When the U.S. weakens, it will demand to be repaid, essentially. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
The elephant in the room is Russia, it seems to me. The plan to weaken Russia and maybe even to bring down the Putin government hasn't worked. Nothing has come to fruition. The Russian army is more experienced and better equipped than it ever has been. The Russian people are behind the war against Ukraine. The Russian economy is strong, stronger than anybody thought it would be at this point. And the Russians, the bottom line really is the Russians are winning the war. What does that mean for the future of American neocons?
Well, it's a massive dent in their plans because this is often referred to as a war of world order, because if it would be possible to knock out the Russians, then the U.S. could focus all its resources on countering China instead. Again, this is what the Keith Kellogg's and Mitt Romney's have been saying all along, and Lindsey Graham, that is, this is a good war. We can use the Ukrainians to knock out Russia, and then the U.S. can use its all its focus and resources on China instead. So, I think this has been the key objective. So if this can't be done, then the whole neocon project for, global dominance, essentially, it begins to fall apart. And I know that a lot of people take some issue with the idea because, they point out that Russia started the war, the West is just helping Ukraine to survive, but I always make the point that this war was started by the NATO countries when we toppled the government of Yanukovych back in 2014. It's worth noting that on the first day after the coup, the CIA and MI6 began to set up a partnership with the Ukrainian intelligence agencies, which they installed a new boss, who, instead of being the main ally of the Russians, would then be a partner for the British and Americans against Russia. We saw that the government was purged, as the general prosecutor of Ukraine later said that the U.S. put in all its own people there. The Washington had to approve all the new appointments into government. We saw in the army, this was also picked and trained by the United States and its allies. It trained also these neo-fascist forces, which would function as a veto on any decisions, Poroshenko or Zelensky got ideas about reaching out to Donbass or the Russians, then these right-wing groups could step in. We saw that the political oppositions were purged, the media, the Orthodox Church. So across the board, when the civil society has been captured by all these NGOs, we see the media is being financed from abroad. So no, this is a country which has been set up for a proxy war. And, many of the neocons are quite open about this. Why this, in Lindsey Graham's words, he said something along the lines that, that I like this format here. You know, they will fight to the last man as long as we send a weapon. So we got ourselves an army of hundreds of thousands of men, which we now can use to drain the Russians.
Yes, indeed. Dr. Glenn Deason, thank you very much for that analysis. Glad you were able to join us today. We just don't know how to take the pedal off the gas. The United States is too entrenched in a policy of intervention and interference in foreign governments. The art of diplomacy, it seems, has been lost. And that isn't going to work forever. Russia has shown that they can stand toe-to-toe with NATO militarily. And China is learning its lesson. Either the United States figures out a way to return to the art of diplomacy, or it might just take a big punch in the mouth to put this bully in its place. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. Please subscribe to my Substack at John Kiriakou. Stay informed, and as always, keep asking the hard questions. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for watching The Whistleblowers.